Chapter 8 Hawks. Theroux was back soon with Sparrowhawk's reply.
He said he'll leave tonight.
Tenar heard this with satisfaction, relieved that he had accepted her plan, that he would get clear away from these messengers and messages he dreaded. It was not till she had fed Heather and Theroux their frog-leg feast, and put Theroux to bed and sung to her, and was sitting up alone without lamp or firelight, that her heart began to sink. He was gone. He was not strong. He was bewildered and uncertain. He needed friends, and she had sent him away from those who were and those who wished to be his friends. He was gone. And she must stay, to keep the hounds from his trail, to learn at least whether they stayed in Gaunt or sailed back to Hafnar. His panic and her obedience to it began to seem so unreasonable to her that she thought it equally unreasonable, improbable, that he would in fact go. He would use his wits and simply hide in Moss's house, which was the last place in all Earthsea that a king would look for an archmage. It would be much better if he stayed there till the king's men left. Then he could come back here to Ogion's house where he belonged, and it would go on as before, she looking after him until he had his strength back and he giving her his dear companionship. A shadow against the stars in the doorway.
Hist! Awake!
Auntie Moss came in.
"Well, he's off,"
she said, conspiratorial, jubilant.
"Went the old forest road. Says he'll cut down to the middle valley way along past Oak Springs tomorrow."
"Good," said Tenar. Bolder than usual, Moss sat down uninvited.
"I gave him a loaf and a bit of cheese for the way."
"Thank you, Moss, that was kind."
"Mistress Gohar."
Moss's voice in the darkness took on the sing-song resonance of her chanting and spell-casting.
"There's a thing I was wanting to say to you, dearie, without going beyond what I can know, for I know you've lived among great folks and been one of them yourself, and that seals my mouth when I think of it. And yet there's things I know that you've had no way of knowing. For all the learning of the runes and the old speech, and all you've learned from the wise and in the foreign lands."
"That's so, Moss."
"Aye. Well, then. So when we talked about how witch knows witch and power knows power, and I said, of him who's gone now, that he was no mage now, whatever he had been, and still you would deny it. But I was right, wasn't I?"
"Yes."
"Aye, I was."
"He said so himself."
"Of course he did. He don't lie nor say this is that and that's this till you don't know which end's up. I'll say that for him. He's not one tries to drive the cart without the ox either. But I'll say flat out, I'm glad he's gone, for it wouldn't do. It wouldn't do any longer, being a different matter with him now and all."
Tenar had no idea what she was talking about, except for her image of trying to drive the cart without the ox. "I don't know why he's so afraid," she said. "Well, I know in part, but I don't understand it. Why he feels such shame. But I know he thinks that he should have died. And I know that all I understand about living is having your work to do and being able to do it. That's the pleasure and the glory and all. And if you can't do the work, or it's taken from you, then what's any good? You have to have something." Moss listened and nodded as at words of wisdom, but after a slight pause she said,
"It's a queer thing for an old man to be a boy of 15, no doubt."
Tenar almost said, "What are you talking about, Moss?" but something prevented her. She realized that she had been listening for Ged to come into the house from his roaming on the mountainside, that she was listening for the sound of his voice, that her body denied his absence. She glanced suddenly over at the witch, a shapeless lump of black perched on Ogion's chair by the empty hearth. "Ah," she said, a great many thoughts suddenly coming into her mind all at once. "That's why," she said. "That's why I never..." After a quite long silence, she said, "Do wizards... Is it a spell?"
"Surely, surely, dearie," said Moss. "They witch themselves. Some'll tell you they make a trade-off, like a marriage turned backward with vows and all, and so get their power then. But to me, that's got a wrong sound to it, like a dealing with the old powers more than what a true witch deals with. And the old mage... He told me they did no such thing. Though I've known some woman witches do it and come to no great harm by it."
"The ones who brought me up did that, promising virginity."
"Oh, aye. No men, you told me. And them eunuchs, terrible."
"But why? But why? Why did I never think..." The witch laughed aloud.
"Because that's the power of them, dearie. You don't think. You can't. And nor do they once they've set their spell. How could they, given their power? It wouldn't do, would it? It wouldn't do. You don't get without you give as much. That's true for all, surely. So they know that. The witch men, the men of power, they know that better than any. But then, you know, it's an uneasy thing for a man not to be a man, no matter if he can call the sun down from the sky. And so they put it right out of mind, with their spells of binding, and truly so. Even in these bad times they've been having, with the spells going wrong and all, I haven't yet heard of a wizard breaking those spells, seeking to use his power for his body's lust. Even the worst would fear to. Of course, there's those will work illusions, but they only fool themselves. And there's witch men of little account, witch tinkers and the like. Some of them will try their own spells of beguilement on country women, but for all I can see, those spells don't amount to much. What it is the one's powers as great as the other, and each goes its own way. That's how I see it."
Tenar sat thinking, absorbed. At last she said, "They set themselves apart."
"Aye, a wizard has to do that."
"But you don't."
"Me? I'm only an old witch woman, dearie."
"How old?" After a minute, Moss's voice in the darkness said, with a hint of laughter in it,
"Old enough to keep out of trouble."
"But you said you haven't been celibate."
"What's that, dearie?"
"Like the wizards."
"Oh, no. Oh, no. Never was anything to look at, but there was a way I could look at them. Not witching, you know, dearie, you know what I mean. There's a way to look, and he'd come round. Sure as a crow will caw, in a day or two or three, he'd come around my place. I need a cure for my dog's mange. I need a tea for my sick granny. But I knew what it was they needed, and if I liked them well enough, maybe they got it. And for love. For love. I'm not one of them, you know. Though maybe some witches are. But they dishonour the art, I say. I do my art for pay, but I take my pleasure for love. That's what I say. Not that it's all pleasure, all that. I was crazy for a man here for a long time, years. A good-looking man he was, but a hard, cold heart. He's long dead. Father to that Townsend who's come back here to live, you know him. Oh, I was so heart-set on that man, I did use my art. I spent many a charm on him, but 'twas all wasted, all for nothing. No blood in a turnip. And I came up here to Ray Albee in the first place when I was a girl because I was in trouble with a man in Gauntport. But I can't talk of that, for they were rich, great folks. 'Twas they had the power, not I. They didn't want their son tangled with a common girl like me. Foul slut, they called me. And they'd have had me put out of the way, like killing a cat, if I hadn't run off up here. But, oh, I did like that lad with his round, smooth arms and legs and his big, dark eyes. I can see him plain as plain after all these years.
They sat a long while silent in the darkness. When you had a man, Moss, did you have to give up your power?
Not a bit of it,
the witch said, complacent. But you said you don't get unless you give. Is it different, then, for men and for women?
What isn't, dearie?
I don't know, Tanar said. It seems to me we make up most of the differences and then complain about them. I don't see why the art magic, why power, should be different for a man-witch and a woman-witch, unless the power itself is different, or the art.
A man gives out, dearie. A woman takes in.
Tanar sat silent, but unsatisfied.
Ours is only a little power, seems like, next to theirs, Moss said, but it goes down deep. It's all roots. It's like an old blackberry thicket, and a wizard's power's like a fir tree. Maybe, great and tall and grand, but it'll blow right down in a storm. Nothing kills a blackberry bramble.
She gave her hen chuckle, pleased with her comparison.
Well then, she said briskly, so as I said, it's maybe just as well he's on his way and out the way. Lest people in the town begin to talk.
To talk?
You're a respectable woman, dearie, and her reputation is a woman's wealth.
Her wealth? Tanar repeated in the same blank way. Then she said it again. Her wealth, her treasure, her hoard, her value. She stood up, unable to sit still, stretching her back and arms. Like the dragons who found caves, who built fortresses for their treasure, for their hoard, to be safe, to sleep on their treasure, to be their treasure, take in, and never give out.
You'll know the value of a good reputation, Moss said dryly, when you've lost it. 'Tisn't everything, but it's hard to fill the place of.
Would you give up being a witch to be respectable, Moss?
I don't know,
Moss said after a while, thoughtfully.
I don't know as I'd know how. I have the one gift, maybe, but not the other.
Tanar went to her and took her hands. Surprised at the gesture, Moss got up, drawing away a little. But Tanar drew her forward and kissed her cheek. The older woman put up one hand and timidly touched Tanar's hair, one caress, as Ogion had used to do. Then she pulled away and muttered about having to go home and started to leave and asked at the door,
"Oh, would you rather I stayed with them foreigners about?"
"Go on," Tanar said. "I'm used to foreigners." That night, as she lay going to sleep, she entered again into the vast gulfs of wind and light. But the light was smoky, red and orange red and amber, as if the air itself were fire. In this element she was and was not, flying on the wind and being the wind, the blowing of the wind, the force that went free, and no voice called to her. In the morning she sat on the doorstep brushing out her hair. She was not fair to blondness like many Kargish people. Her skin was pale, but her hair dark. It was still dark, hardly a thread of grey in it. She had washed it, using some of the water that was heating to wash clothes in, for she had decided the laundry would be her day's work, Ged being gone and her respectability secure. She dried her hair in the sun, brushing it. In the hot, windy morning, sparks followed the brush and crackled from the flying ends of her hair. Tharoo came to stand behind her, watching. Tinar turned and saw her so intent, she was almost trembling. "What is it, Birdlet?"
"The fire! Flying out!"
the child said, with fear or exultation.
"All over the sky!"
"It's just the sparks from my hair," Tinar said, a little taken aback. Tharoo was smiling, and she did not know if she had ever seen the child smile before. Tharoo reached out both her hands, the whole one and the burned, as if to touch and follow the flight of something around Tanar's loose floating hair.
"The fire's all flying out,"
she repeated, and she laughed. At that moment, Tinar first asked herself how Tharoo saw her, saw the world, and knew she did not know. That she could not know what one saw with an eye that had been burned away. And Ogion's words, "They will fear her," returned to her. But she felt no fear of the child. Instead, she brushed her hair again, vigorously, so the sparks would fly, and once again she heard the little husky laugh of delight. She washed the sheets, the dishcloths, her shifts and spare dress, and Tharoo's dresses, and laid them out, after making sure the goats were in the fenced pasture, in the meadow to dry on the dry grass, weighting down the things with stones, for the wind was gusty with a late summer wildness in it. Tharoo had been growing. She was still very small and thin for her age, which must be about 8. But in the last couple of months, with her injuries healed at last and free of pain, she had begun to run about more and to eat more. She was fast outgrowing her clothes, hand-me-downs from Lark's youngest, a girl of 5. Tinar thought she might walk into the village and visit with Weaver Fan, and see if he might have an end or two of cloth to give in exchange for the swill she had been sending for his pigs. She would like to sew something for Tharoo, and she would like to visit with old Fan too. Ogion's death and Ged's illness had kept her from the village and the people she had known there. They had pulled her away as ever from what she knew how to do, the world she had chosen to live in. A world not of kings and queens, great powers and dominions, high arts and journeys and adventures. She thought as she made sure Tharoo was with Heather and set off into town, but of common people doing common things, such as marrying and bringing up children and farming and sewing and doing the wash. She thought this with a kind of vengefulness, as if she were thinking it at Ged, now, no doubt, halfway to Middle Valley. She imagined him on the road near the dell where she and Tharoo had slept. She imagined the slight ashen-haired man going along alone and silently with half a loaf of the witch's bread in his pocket and a load of misery in his heart. "It's time you found out, maybe," she thought to him. "Time you learned that you didn't learn everything on Roke." As she harangued him thus in her mind, Another image came into it. She saw, near Ged, one of the men who had stood waiting for her and Tharu on that road. Involuntarily, she said, "Ged, be careful." Fearing for him, for he did not carry even a stick. It was not the big fellow with hairy lips that she saw, but another of them, a youngish man with a leather cap, the one who had stared hard at Tharu. She looked up to see the little cottage next to Fan's house, where she had lived when she lived here. Between it and her, a man was passing. It was the man she had been remembering, imagining, the man with the leather cap. He was going past the cottage, past the weaver's house. He had not seen her. She watched him walk on up the village street without stopping. He was going either to the turning of the hill road or to the mansion house. Without pausing to think why, Tanar followed him at a distance until she saw which turn he took. He went on up the hill to the domain of the Lord of Rey Albi, not down the road that Ged had gone. She turned back then and made her visit to Old Fan. Though almost a recluse like many weavers, Fan had been kind in his shy way to the Kargish girl and vigilant. How many people, she thought, had protected her respectability? Now nearly blind, Fan had an apprentice who did most of the weaving. He was glad to have a visitor. He sat as if in state in an old carved chair under the object from which his use name came, a very large painted fan, the treasure of his family, the gift, so the story went, of a generous sea pirate to his grandfather for some speedy sail-making in time of need. It was displayed open on the wall. The delicately painted men and women in their gorgeous robes of rose and jade and azure, the towers and bridges and banners of Hafnar Great Port, were all familiar to Tanar as soon as she saw the fan again. Visitors to Rey Albi were often brought to see it. It was the finest thing, all agreed, in the village. She admired it, knowing it would please the old man, and because it was indeed very beautiful. And he said,
"You've not seen much to equal that in all your travels, eh?"
"No, no. Nothing like it in Middle Valley at all," said she.
"When you was here in my cottage, did I ever show you the other side of it?"
"The other side?"
"No," she said. "And nothing would do then but he must get the fan down." Only she had to climb up and do it, carefully untucking it, since he could not see well enough and could not climb up on the chair. He directed her anxiously. She laid it in his hands, and he peered with his dim eyes at it, half closed it to make sure the ribs played freely, then closed it all the way, turned it over, and handed it to her.
"Open it slow," he said.
She did so. Dragons moved as the folds of the fan moved, painted faint and fine on the yellowed silk. Dragons of pale red, blue, green, moved and grouped as the figures on the other side were grouped among clouds and mountain peaks.
"Hold it up to the light," said Old Fan.
She did so, and saw the two sides, the two paintings made one by the light flowing through the silk, so that the clouds and peaks were the towers of the city, and the men and women were winged, and the dragons looked with human eyes.
"You see?"
"I see," she murmured.
"I can't now, but it's in my mind's eye. I don't show many that."
"It is very wonderful."
"I meant to show it to the old mage," Fan said, "but with one thing and another I never did."
Tanar turned the fan once more before the light, then remounted it as it had been, the dragons hidden in darkness, the men and women walking in the light of day. Fan took her out next to see his pigs, a fine pair, fattening nicely toward autumn sausages. They discussed Heather's shortcomings as a swill carrier. Tanar told him that she fancied a scrap of cloth for a child's dress, and he was delighted, pulling out a full width of fine linen sheeting for her, while the young woman, who was his apprentice, and who seemed to have taken up his unsociability as well as his craft, clacked away at the broad loom, steady and scowling. Walking home, Tanar thought of Tharu sitting at that loom. It would be a decent living. The bulk of the work was dull, always the same over. But weaving was an honourable trade, and in some hands a noble art. And people expected weavers to be a bit shy, often to be unmarried, shut away at their work as they were. Yet they were respected, and working indoors at a loom, Tharu would not have to show her face. But the claw hand, could that hand throw the shuttle, warp the loom? And was she to hide all her life? But what was she to do? Knowing what her life must be. Tanar set herself to think of something else, of the dress she would make. Lark's daughter's dresses were coarse, homespun, plain as mud. She could dye half this width, yellow maybe, or with red madder from the marsh, and then a full apron or overdress of white with a ruffle to it. Was the child to be hidden at a loom in the dark and never have a ruffle to her skirt? And that would still leave enough for a shift and a second apron if she cut out carefully. Tharu, she called as she approached the house. Heather and Tharu had been in the broom pasture when she left. She called again, wanting to show Tharu the material and tell her about the dress. Heather came gawking around from the spring house, hauling Sippy on a rope. "Where's Tharu?" "With you," Heather replied so serenely that Tanar looked around for the child before she understood that Heather had no idea where she was, and had simply stated what she wished to be true. "Where did you leave her?" Heather had no idea. She had never let Tanar down before. She had seemed to understand that Tharu had to be kept more or less in sight, like a goat. But maybe it was Tharu all along who had understood that, and had kept herself in sight. So Tanar thought. As having no comprehensible guidance from Heather, she began to look and call for the child, receiving no response. She kept away from the cliff's edge as long as she could. Their first day there, she had explained to Tharu that she must never go alone down the steep fields below the house or along the sheer edge north of it, because one-eyed vision cannot judge distance or depth with certainty. The child had obeyed. She always obeyed. But children forget. But she would not forget. But she might get close to the edge without knowing it. But surely she had gone to Moss's house. That was it. Having been there alone last night, she would go again. That was it, of course. She was not there. Moss had not seen her.
"I'll find her. I'll find her, dearie," she assured Tanar. But instead of going up the forest path to look for her, as Tanar had hoped she would, Moss began to knot up her hair in preparation for casting a spell of finding. Tanar ran back to Ogian's house, calling again and again, and this time she looked down the steep fields below the house, hoping to see the little figure crouched playing among the boulders. But all she saw was the sea, wrinkled and dark, at the end of those falling fields, and she grew dizzy and sick-hearted. She went to Ogian's grave and a short way past it up the forest path, calling. As she came back through the meadow,
The kestrel was hunting in the same spot where Ged had watched it hunt. This time it stooped and struck and rose with some little creature in its talons. It flew fast to the forest. She's feeding her young, Tanar thought. All kinds of thoughts went through her mind, very vivid and precise, as she passed the laundry laid out on the grass. Dry now. She must take it up before evening. She must search around the house, the spring house, the milking shed, more carefully. This was her fault. She had caused it to happen by thinking of making Tharu into a weaver, shutting her away in the dark to work to be respectable. When Ogion had said, teach her all, Tanar. When she knew that a wrong that cannot be repaired must be transcended. When she knew that the child had been given her, and she had failed in her charge, failed her trust, lost her, lost the one great gift. She went into the house, having searched every corner of the other buildings, and looked again in the alcove and round the other bed. She poured herself water, for her mouth was dry as sand. Behind the door, the three sticks of wood, Ogion's staff and the walking sticks, moved in the shadows, and one of them said, "Here." The child was crouched in that dark corner, drawn into her own body so that she seemed no bigger than a little dog, head bent down to the shoulder, arms and legs pulled tight in, the one eye shut. "Little bird, little sparrow, little flame, what is wrong? What happened? What have they done to you now?" Tanar held the small body, closed and stiff as stone, rocking it in her arms. "How could you frighten me so? How could you hide from me? Oh, I was so angry." She wept, and her tears fell on the child's face. "Oh, Tharu, 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 don't hide away from me." A shadow went through the knotted limbs, and slowly they loosened. Tharu moved, and all at once clung to Tanar, pushing her face into the hollow between Tanar's breast and shoulder, clinging tighter till she was clutching desperately. She did not weep. She never wept. Her tears had been burned out of her, maybe. She had none, but she made a long, moaning, sobbing sound. Tanar held her, rocking her, rocking her. Very, very slowly the desperate grip relaxed. The head lay pillowed on Tanar's breast. "Tell me," the woman murmured, and the child answered in her faint, hoarse whisper. "He came here." Tanar's first thought was of Ged, and her mind, still moving with the quickness of fear, caught that, saw who he was to her, and gave it a wry grin in passing, but passed on, hunting. "Who came here?" No answer, but a kind of internal shuddering. "A man?" Tanar said quietly. "A man in a leather cap?" Tharu nodded once. "We saw him on the road coming here." No response. "The four men, the ones I was angry at, do you remember? He was one of them." But she recalled how Tharu had held her head down, hiding the burned side, not looking up as she had always done among strangers. "Do you know him, Tharu?"
"Yes.
From when you lived in the camp by the river." One nod. Tanar's arms tightened around her. "He came here?" she said, and all the fear she had felt turned as she spoke into anger, a rage that burned in her the length of her body like a rod of fire. She gave a kind of laugh. "Ha!" and remembered in that moment Carlesson. How Carlesson had laughed. But it was not so simple for a human and a woman. The fire must be contained, and the child must be comforted. "Did he see you?"
"I hid."
Presently Tanar said, stroking Tharu's hair, he will never touch you, Tharu. Understand me and believe me. He will never touch you again. He'll never see you again unless I'm with you, and then he must deal with me. Do you understand, my dear, my precious, my beautiful? You need not fear him. You must not fear him. He wants you to fear him. He feeds on your fear. We will starve him, Tharu. We'll starve him till he eats himself, till he chokes, gnawing on the bones of his own hands. Oh, don't listen to me now. I'm only angry, only angry. Am I red? Am I red like a Gontish woman now, like a dragon? Am I red? She tried to joke, and Tharu, lifting her head, looked up into her face from her own crumpled, tremulous, fire-eaten face and said, "Yes, you are a red dragon." The idea of the man's coming to the house, being in the house, coming around to look at his handiwork, maybe thinking of improving on it. That idea, whenever it recurred to Thénard, came less as a thought than as a queasy fit, a need to vomit. But the nausea burned itself out against the anger. They got up and washed, and Thénard decided that what she felt most of all just now was hunger. "I am hollow," she said to Tharu, and set them out a substantial meal of bread and cheese, cold beans in oil and herbs, a sliced onion and dry sausage. Tharu ate a good deal, and Thénard ate a great deal. As they cleared up, she said, "For the present, Tharu, I won't leave you at all, and you won't leave me, right? And we should both go now to Auntie Moss's house. She was making a spell to find you, and she needn't bother to go on with it, but she might not know that." Tharu stopped moving. She glanced once at the open doorway and shrank away from it. "We need to bring in the laundry, too, on our way back. And when we're back, I'll show you the cloth I got today, for a dress, for a new dress for you, a red dress." The child stood, drawing into herself. "If we hide Tharu, we feed him. We will eat, and we will starve him. Come with me." The difficulty, the barrier of that doorway to the outside was tremendous to Tharu. She shrank from it. She hid her face. She trembled, stumbled. It was cruel to force her to cross it, cruel to drive her out of hiding, but Thénard was without pity. "Come," she said, and the child came. They walked hand in hand across the fields to Moss's house. Once or twice Tharu managed to look up. Moss was not surprised to see them, but she had a queer, wary look about her. She told Tharu to run inside her house to see the ring-necked hen's new chicks and choose which two might be hers, and Tharu disappeared at once into that refuge. "She was in the house all along," Thénard said, "hiding."
"Well, she might," said Moss.
"Why?" Thénard asked harshly. She was not in the hiding vein.
There's beings about,"
the witch said, not portentously, but uneasily.
"There's scoundrels about," said Thénard, and Moss looked at her and drew back a little. "And now," she said, "hey, dearie, you have a fire around you, a shining of fire all about your head. I cast the spell to find the child, but it didn't go right. It went its own way somehow, and I don't know yet if it's ended. I'm bewildered. I saw great beings. I sought the little girl, but I saw them flying in the mountains, flying in the clouds. And now you have that about you, like your hair was afire. What's amiss? What's wrong?"
"A man in a leather cap," Thénard said. "A youngish man, well enough looking. The shoulder seam of his vest torn. Have you seen him round?" Moss nodded.
"They took him on for the haying at the mansion house,"
I told you that she, Tanar glanced at the house, was with a woman and two men. He's one of them.
You mean one of them that...
Yes. Moss stood like a wood carving of an old woman, rigid, a block.
I don't know, she said at last. I thought I knew enough, but I don't.
What
would... Would he come to see her?
If he's the father, maybe he's come to claim her.
Claim her?
She's his property. Tanar spoke evenly. She looked up at the heights of Gaunt Mountain as she spoke. But I think it's not the father. I think this is the other one. The one that came and told my friend in the village that the child had hurt herself. Moss was still bewildered, still frightened by her own conjurations and visions, by Tanar's fierceness, by the presence of abominable evil. She shook her head, desolate.
I don't know, she said. I thought I knew enough. How could he come back?
To eat, Tanar said. To eat. I won't be leaving her alone again. But tomorrow, Moss, I might ask you to keep her here an hour or so early in the day. Would you do that while I go up to the manor house?
Aye, dearie, of course. I could put a hiding spell on her if you like, but they're up there, the great men from the king's city.
Why then? They can see how life is among the common folk, said Tanar. And Moss drew back again, as if from a rush of sparks blown her way from a fire in the wind.